This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The famine in South Sudan is man-made. It is the result of ongoing conflict in that country. It is the result of an apparent campaign against the civilian population. It is the result of killing humanitarian workers, 16 in this year alone. It is the result of denying starving people access to the food and medicine that will save their lives.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley briefing the U.N. Security Council on the worsening situation in South Sudan.
Also, an urgent plea for the EU to help at least 23,000 unaccompanied migrant children in refugee camps. And a new study reveals the challenges for children of mothers who were abducted by Uganda's Lord's Resistance Army.
We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN Security Council heard testimony yesterday on the worsening humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. UN Special Representative and head of the UN mission in South Sudan, David Shearer, briefed the council on the situation there. He says UN personnel face extremely difficult challenges trying to help those in need.
For example, a convoy delivering humanitarian supplies from Juba to Benchu in the north, a distance of about 1,000 kilometres or 600 miles, takes over 2 weeks. And that's a function of the appalling roads, but it's also a function of the need to negotiate through 90 different official and the majority of unofficial checkpoints along the way. UNMISS currently directly protects over 220,000 civilians in six different locations around the country. The largest site, which is in Benchu with 125,000 people, is the second largest urban area in South Sudan. And I have no doubt of thousands of civilians would not be alive today if not for the presence of UNMISS. Now more than ever, 12,000 UN blue helmets and 2,000 UN police officers are vital to protect civilians.
Shearer says the crisis is growing steadily worse, and that includes fighting between government forces and rebels.
Since last year, the security, economic and humanitarian situation have worsened markedly. Just in the last few days, the currency devalued dramatically, leaving the government struggling to meet its financial obligations. And as the frustrations mount, there is risk of instability. Virtually no part of the country is immune from conflict. Yet there has been no concerted effort by any party to adhere to a ceasefire. Instead, over the past month, we are seeing an actual intensification of the conflict.
He says fighting in South Sudan is often along ethnic lines and continues to displace many civilians.
Since the beginning of this year, 60,000 civilians each month have fled from the Equatorias to Uganda. Most, unfortunately, again, are farmers depopulating from what once which was the breadbasket of South Sudan. And it means that when they leave these areas, they are no longer involved in the production of food. And it's estimated by FAO that around 1,000 metric tons of locally produced food are lost to South Sudan as a result. When I was meeting with a group of religious leaders just recently in Tarit, one of the towns in the south, they told me that around three-quarters of the population of Tarit had already fled to Uganda.
Now, the UN head of mission for South Sudan says overall, one-third of the population is now either displaced within the country or has fled to neighbouring countries. Shearer calls the crisis there a man-made disaster. Agreeing with that assessment is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, who currently is Security Council president.
The famine in South Sudan is man-made. It is the result of ongoing conflict in that country. It is the result of an apparent campaign against the civilian population. It is the result of killing humanitarian workers, 16 in this year alone. It is the result of denying starving people access to the food and medicine that will save their lives. That is the reason there is famine in South Sudan.
Well, Haley says the UN is doing a better job of protecting civilians. However, she sharply criticized the warring parties.
The parties to the conflict in South Sudan have little to no progress to report. Last month, we issued a presidential statement that called on all parties to take several urgent steps. As we meet here today, none of these steps have been taken, not one. We called on the warring parties to immediately adhere to a ceasefire. There is no ceasefire in South Sudan today. Instead, there are reports of serious human rights violations and abuses and violations of international humanitarian law, many at the hands of government forces. Thousands of civilians continue to pour out of the country to escape the conflict. So many people have fled the violence that Uganda is now home to the world's largest refugee camp. We called on South Sudan to allow our peacekeepers to do their job, a job that includes protecting civilians, monitoring and investigating human rights, and creating conditions for the delivery of humanitarian aid. We called on the warring parties to allow humanitarian organizations to do their job. Neither of these things has happened. The government continues to obstruct the peacekeeping mission from reaching those most in need. Aid workers continue to be killed trying to help the victims. In fact, South Sudan is the most dangerous country in the world for aid workers today. More people die trying to help in South Sudan than in any other country. It's not even close.
Well, the U.S. ambassador says it is time the Security Council acknowledges that its requests have been ignored. Haley also took the council to task for the way members responded to the testimony of the U.N. head of mission in South Sudan.
I sat here and I watched the many statements that were given in thanks to Mr. Shearer. And it was nice, and they were genuine. But you gave him no help whatsoever to do his job, because you're allowing President Kiir to continue to do what he's doing. We're continuing to talk about how sorry we are for the people of South Sudan. We're continuing to talk about how we wish there was national dialogue, but yet there's no dialogue to be had. We talk about how we wish we could get humanitarian workers in there, but we're not doing anything to force the government. We talk about how much more needs to be done in South Sudan, yet no one is stepping up and saying, let's do it. If you truly appreciate the work Mr. Shearer is doing, if you truly care for the people of South Sudan, then we must tell the South Sudanese government that we are not going to put up with this anymore. If you care about the leadership of this Security Council, we should not allow a presidential statement to be totally ignored. And the person that's benefiting from the division of this council is the South Sudanese government.
And that was Nikki Haley, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, speaking there.
About 100,000 women die every year around the world from severe bleeding after childbirth, but a clinical trial says an inexpensive and readily available drug could save many lives. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
About 20,000 women from 21 countries took part in the woman trial. Most of them were African and Asian. Halima Shakur is the trial's project director. She's associate professor of clinical trials at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
The problem we've been looking at is something called postpartum hemorrhage. This is where women bleed severely after giving birth. And it's one of the biggest killer of mothers. You know, mothers go into childbirth expecting everything to happen normally. But in Africa and Asia, about 10% of women will end up with severe bleeding.
She says bleeding after childbirth kills one woman every 6 minutes, and it often happens without warning.
When a woman is pregnant, her womb, her uterus, is stretched by the baby growing. And when she gives birth, the womb doesn't contract down fully. And so you start to get bleeding at the site where the baby was attached to the mother. And that's the most common cause of postpartum hemorrhage.
A woman is more at risk for bleeding if she gives birth to more than one baby, or if she's anemic, or has had a cesarean section in the past. Professor Shakur says the trial focused on the drug tranexamic acid, also known as TXA. It's been around for a long time.
Tranexamic acid was actually invented by some academics, a couple who were working at a university in Japan, and this was over 50 years ago. This was in post-war Japan, where everything was scarce, and they wanted to do research that wouldn't cost a lot of money, so the most freely available thing is blood. And they started looking at what research they can do using blood.
The husband and wife team developed the drug to stop postpartum hemorrhage. It was common in Japan following World War II. However, they were never able to convince doctors to conduct a clinical trial. It took about 50 years for that to happen. The trial in which Shakur took part was done between 2004 and 2010. It was called the CRASH II trial, and it focused on the use of TXA during treatment for trauma. The drug worked by slowing the breakdown of blood clots, thereby reducing death due to bleeding. The woman trial was finally conducted for its use during childbirth. Shakur says the idea for the woman trial actually came from Nigerian doctors. They saw the trauma study and asked why research was not being done on whether TXA could stop bleeding in childbirth.
I think they felt that they needed other treatments to save the lives of these women.
Using the drug, doctors did not have to resort to surgery to find the source of the bleeding. But the timing of the treatment is important.
Any doctor that's looking after a woman with postpartum hemorrhage must consider giving her tranexamic acid. And it's really important that they give it quite early, because the earlier you give it, so within the first 3 hours of giving birth, the better the effect. In fact, overall, we saw a 20% reduction in death due to bleeding, whereas in women who received the treatment within the first 3 hours, it was 30%.
The woman trial results are published in The Lancet. Funding came from the Wellcome Trust, Britain's Health Department, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A European Union official is urging immediate help for at least 23,000 unaccompanied child refugees. He says they're stranded in horrific living conditions in Greek and Italian refugee camps. Claude Moraes, chair of the European Parliament's Justice and Home Affairs Committee, says he is alarmed at the findings of a new study. It found camp life for children in Greek and Italian hotspots is unsafe. They are exposed to child abuse, including rape, smuggling, and overall lack of security, water, and decent food. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the report and the EU's response to it.
Well, this has come from an official European Union audit warning that urgent action is needed to help unaccompanied child refugees that are being held in unsafe Greek and Italian refugee camps. Now, these camps in Italy are described as hotspots. They're holding centres where migrants arrive and they're supposedly being processed before they're being sent somewhere else. Now, there's a concern that there's a lack of security in these locations, poor food and water and facilities, and these minors are particularly exposed to exploitation. Really, their security is at risk in these particular locations. Claude Moraes, the chair of the European Parliament's Justice and Home Affairs Committee, he says that this report is very alarming and shows how there are failures among the members of the European Union. And he says that the amount of child abuse, rape, and even smuggling that is going on in these centres is horrific.
What is he saying the EU should be doing about this?
Well, he says that many unaccompanied minors are being held for far too long in inappropriate conditions, and there needs to be priority to actually processing them, registering them, and then insisting that there is some form of child protection. Child protection officer should be appointed, according to the EU, to ensure that children's rights are protected. We've seen so many arrivals just this year. More than 30,000 migrants have landed in Italy across the Mediterranean since the beginning of the year. Still not doing enough, according to the EU, to ensure that young children and minors are protected.
So these children are coming across the Mediterranean by themselves. So where are they from? Is there any way they can be reunited with their families?
Well, almost 90% of the child migrants that are being held in Greek hotspots come from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. In the Italian camps, there seem to be more than 20,000 children, and they are predominantly from African countries affected by conflict, famine, persecution, and they come from countries like Nigeria and Eritrea. And very few of those, according to the EU, are being protected. They're often sleeping in unsegregated adult facilities with little security and often surrounded by the threat of violence. This, according to the EU, has disastrous consequences for children, and these officials are insisting that their rights are protected.
And looking at the situation in Libya, I understand the humanitarian situation there is also continuing to deteriorate. Can you tell us the latest on that?
In the last few months, we've seen some alarming reports and updates from organizations, including Doctors Without Borders, very concerned about the situation in Libya, the lawlessness, the domination of the militias on the streets, and their control of the people smuggling network between Libya and Europe. Now, Dr. Tancred Sturbe, the former head of Doctors Without Borders in Germany, is reporting on a visit that he made to Libya to give a medical assessment. It took him from Misrata to Tripoli. And in his update, he describes the most appalling living conditions in a detention center between Misrata and Tripoli. And he says among the detainees were women from Egypt, Guinea, Niger, and Nigeria who had had no contact with the outside world. They were living in small, dirty rooms. There were puddles of urine. There were no showers. The toilets didn't function. Very little drinking water, and he said that these migrants were utterly desperate and begging him to offer them help and even try and send them back to their home countries because they were just so upset and suffering from so much trauma.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome.
It's 22 past the hour, and you're with Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. For most children abducted by terror groups or militias, freedom brings relief and hope of a better future. But a new study says that's not the case for some children who were born in captivity under the Ugandan rebel group the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA. The study found that children of mothers who were abducted, held captive, and raped by the rebels often face major challenges after their liberation. Miriam Denov is the lead author of the study. She's also a professor in the School of Social Work at McGill University in Montreal. Reporter William Eagle asked her why captivity can make children feel that war is sometimes better than peace.
So these children were born in captivity, and so they very much spent their early years, their formative years, within the LRA, and in some cases grew up in the context of the LRA. So that was really all that they knew. And for many of them, they were too young to understand the relationship between their mother and their father and the fact that it was a forced marriage. And so in many cases, the children talked about having this very strong sense of family, that, you know, they had their mother present, they had their father present, and that this father, in fact, was seen as a very protective and caring figure. And they didn't know what the father was doing on the war front, but only saw him within the, you know, the domestic sphere. And oftentimes these fathers lavished great attention on these children and, in fact, were quite valued in the LRA. So they had a very unique view of their father. They also had a sense of power and status within the LRA because of who their father was. In many cases, the children's father was a high-ranking commander. In some cases, the children that we talked to were, in fact, their father was Joseph Kony. And so they were taught that they were unique and special and that people within the LRA should treat them as such. And so you bring sort of fast forward to the post-war period where these children face incredible forms of stigma and marginalization based on who they are and their former affiliation with the LRA. And as a result, there's sort of a nostalgia for what life was like in the LRA. And the fact is now they have very fragmented families. The father is, for the most part, not present, has either died or is no longer is missing, or they don't have contact with the father. And they may be in a reconstituted family where there is tension in that family because of their origins. So as a result, there is this sort of feeling like, you know what, my family situation was actually better before.
How are the children treated once they are resettled?
Well, these are the main challenges. I mean, the first one that I mentioned already is the stigma that, you know, within the family, within their school, within the larger community, people tend to know who they are and where their origins are. And so they feel very targeted, and they talk about being singled out, being called Coney children, and being called dangerous rebels. And so this has a huge impact on their everyday life. They also experiencing violence within the family. And they also talked about having, as compared to other children who were born after the war, having limited access to school as well as health care, that if there were funds available to send a child to school, that those funds would often go to children who were born after the war, not the children born in captivity. And similar situation in relation to health, that if they were sick, they would say, you know what, they don't take me to the hospital when I'm sick, but they will take my sibling who was born from home to the hospital when I'm sick.
Does your study make any recommendations for the children who have not integrated into their new communities? And what do the community members need to understand?
Well, one of the things that we did during the study was ask the children themselves what they thought were their recommendations. One was, you know, livelihood programs, because they don't want to live in the past, they want to move forward. And one of the things that's missing in their lives are income-generating activities to support themselves and their families. So that was really important, because they wanted to send themselves to school. If their family wasn't going to be providing those school fees, they wanted to be able to make those school fees themselves. So that was one thing. And also community sensitization programs to make the community aware of who they are, what they went through, and what they're going through now. And this was, you know, really important to them. And one of the things that we tried to do since initially the research is putting together a radio talk show that the children actually host to inform people what they're going through, and to sensitize people to some of the challenges that they face within their families and at school. They also talked about counseling. There was often a very tense or ambivalent relationship between the mother and the child, given the context in which they were born, how they grew up, and the struggle to manage the family in the post-war period, given the complexity of changing family structures. So one of the things that they also talked about was having better communication with their mothers. And one of the important things for them was knowing the truth about what happened to them and where they came from, because oftentimes the mother really struggled to answer questions about their origins. And the mothers struggled to give them that information, trying to protect them. So that the idea of sort of truth-telling was very important to the children and was a struggle, and so they wanted to be able to communicate better with their mothers and their families and extended families about their origins.
That was Professor Miriam Denov of McGill University's School of Social Work. She spoke to VOA's William Eagle. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am your host Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Zimbabwe's persistent economic woes cloud its 37th Independence Day celebration. An in-depth discussion on Zimbabwe on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.